Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And just imagine that, placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. There's a lot of things I can cover on that, but bottom line, I am actually working on, and as I mentioned yesterday, and I think I mentioned it previously the day before or last time I talked to Angeline, that I am working on a presentation. I've done a presentation already in Wyoming, not Idaho, and this presentation was focused on why are we stuck in a binary conversation regarding what do we do about getting the government back into control? Now, there's one group that, you know, actually, I'm not going to dive into that. I'll dive into that presentation later. But understanding, I'm just going to try to give you the macro view here. When it comes to understanding the Constitution, there are you and my audience that actually have been listening long enough that you understand this. But I want you to understand what kind of club you're a member of, because you're very elite. And I don't mean that because you listen to me. I mean that because you care enough to understand and learn and listen to the Constitution and how we help you understand not just the intent, but the terms and definitions and how these mechanisms work, interplay, and so forth in the paradigm of the framers. So you really are, you're at a point of understanding that you, believe it or not, you can actually start having debates with constitutional lawyers and do circles around these guys because they believe in this living document. They believe they have the authority to interpret and twist the law and dictate. They believe that they are the oligarchy at the Supreme Court level. They are the oligarchy that rules this nation and keeps it together. Oh, what a beautiful, noble concept that they have such power. You can't tell me that they haven't been aggrandizing themselves to get to that point. But clearly, they don't have those powers based on the Constitution. They are limited to only those things arising under the Constitution. Now, you hear me talk a lot about state constitutions and having that 10th Amendment embedded in that. The same thing with judicial powers. Your state judiciary needs to be limited and defined to only those powers delegated to it so that all powers of, you know, all things that, you know, actually matter will be left at the county to your common law courts. Now, if San Francisco wants to actually, you know, allow people to steal, then that will be dealt at the San Francisco court because the state court will have no jurisdiction. And so either San Francisco court either steps in and follows common law or whatever the laws are. And if they actually make it legal, then they'll support that. And tyranny and the hand of tyranny will become very visible because bottom line, see, folks, we actually have all of these players that shouldn't even be playing in the game enabling this behavior. So when we see this national agenda, people think it's actually coming from the national agenda. And it's actually really evil, bad players down at the county level that are playing these shenanigans where it doesn't play elsewhere. Not sure if that really makes sense, but bottom line, the law and common law will dictate the behavior of the people in the county common law courts. This is why common law courts need to be restored. If the people say, you got to remember that the common law courts in Britain, there's a lot of, I know that they're really good, righteous people out there that want to bring biblical courts back into action. In other words, establishing a theocracy. We can't go down that path. We can't because the law doesn't allow us. Because equal protection means equal protection. Just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you have an advantage in the eyes of the law here in America. And we shouldn't. We should always look at each other. Are we not all children, you know, of our Creator? anyway, I don't want to necessarily stay down at this level, but bottom line, I haven't brought in Paul because Paul's not here today. And what that means is that I'm having to pull, or I should say push forward, and in doing so, I will start diving into Madison's notes on nullification. Now, there's a backstory to this that I won't necessarily get into because I don't know all the facts and details of why he sat down in 1834, other than the fact that the nation was actually in the grasp of a perversion of what he and Jefferson did. And he clearly responded in defense of precisely what they did and how he actually defined it, how he provided all the details of what he was doing and Jefferson was doing in 1798, 1799. And because the nation had wandered along down this path. So you're going to see some terms that he uses. And so as I read, instead of kind of reading and waiting for Paul to get to a point or cutting him off, I'm just going to kind of read along and insert. And I know I got to be really careful, so I'll try to remember that I'm inserting here. So that way you understand what this document says and how I'm explaining it to you. Because, you know, at the very, very beginning, he starts this off and he says, and this is the document. He says, although the legislature of Virginia declared at a late season, almost unanimously, he's now giving us insight. I'm inserting this. He's now giving us insight in how things played out at the state legislature in 1798. When he went in to have them do the Virginia resolutions, they all declared almost unanimously in the late season. So what does that mean? He's telling you that they were almost done with their session for the year. They've barely got it across the line before they would have been involved in doing a new session. But I believe based on the election rotation, it was their first session of the 2 years for the state legislature. So they got it done because I don't think they met during the winter time. They didn't do much work at that point in time until, you know, the seasons became favorable. I think 9 times out of 10, I believe they started meeting or started conducting business. When I look at Congress, when I look at some of the states as they functioned, they really didn't convene into a session until late spring, early summer. Why? Because they had plants to crop. They had, you know, plants to crop. They had seeds they had to plant for their crops, and they had their agrarian responsibilities that they had to do before they could just kind of leave it into a maintenance mode for whether they were self-employed, you know, the northern states where they were doing it themselves, like in Pennsylvania and so forth, or whether in the southern states. I mean, those were the slave states, so they actually had that. But there was this commonality that there was business to be attended to, and it was important business because that's what kept the family alive. And then when they had these points in time, and things have kind of shifted nowadays. As a matter of fact, we're at a point where we don't have time for anything. We're at a time where we as a society don't have downtime. We work, you know, 52 weeks out of the year, unless you take a vacation. They didn't have a life like that. We work far more today. And, you know, in a way, we live a much better life. But most people live from hand to hand. In other words, from paycheck to paycheck. So anyway, let me move on here. He says, although the legislature of Virginia declared at a late season, almost unanimously, that South Carolina was not supported in her doctrine of nullification by the resolutions of 1798, it appears that those resolutions still appealed to as expressly or constructively favoring the doctrine. Now, he's tying what they did in 1798 to what South Carolina is doing at the current moment. that the doctrine of nullification, and this is what South Carolina is doing, folks. They're calling for single state nullification. We're not going to abide by this. We're not going to abide by that federal law. You know, you want to try to punish us? We're not going to abide by it. We're going to go ahead and do things. We're going to bypass the federal laws that are being inflicted upon us. So he goes, that the doctrine of nullification may be clearly understood, it must be taken as laid down in the report of a special committee of the House of Representatives of South Carolina in 1828. In that document, it is asserted that a single state has a constitutional right to arrest the execution of the law of the United States within its limits, that the arrest is to be presumed right and valid and is to remain in force unless 3/4 of the states on a convention shall otherwise decide. Now, I'm going to stop right here. There are lots of people that are going around, and some people are mislabeling interposition and nullification. And some people are looking at, you know, this nullification or arresting these laws as you know, this is a constitutional process. And we're going to hear from Madison that it's not. Madison's actually going to tell us what has to happen. What has to happen is we have to start holding everybody in the state accountable and getting everybody in the union to do its job. See, if it's coming from down on high, in other words, if the problem is your governor, then you need to get all your counties on board to stopping your governor. You shouldn't be operating as a rogue county saying, we're not going to do this. I mean, that's a good thing, and that's absolute resistance. And here's what I'm going to say. That by the concept of the union, and even though these laws are unjust and unconstitutional, sometimes it requires civil disobedience, which is what these counties during the pandemic did, if you've seen some of these videos and so forth. And so it's not that they were doing the right thing. What they were doing was they were doing the last ditch effort that they needed, but they don't have the freedom or the ability to actually divorce themselves. In other words, see, a state, as Madison's going to get into this, a state has the ability to secede from the union due to the violations of the compact. It's the same thing at the state level. If your governor, well, it's actually not the same thing, but I mean, it's playing in the same vein, but the state, the counties don't have the power and authority that a state does in the U.S. Constitution, because you just can't become an island in that state, because it just doesn't work out that way. The way the states have been framed, even though the counties are sovereign, they require a cooperation. They require a unification of the counties. So this is why, folks, your counties matter so much. I can't emphasize this enough. At the state level, a state can secede. At a county level, you can't. You have to actually appeal to all of the people of the county. And it's not that hard. If the people are doing their due diligence, the lesson we should be taking away from the pandemic is, first off, the few counties that actually rose up as identified in some of these movies. And there's one that talks about the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. And I won't dive into that at this point. But that one actually, you know, successfully says, we're not going to support this. You want to wage warfare against us? You want to bring the militias down and descend upon us? Then bring it on. You know, we're willing to fight to the death. And fortunately, you know, everybody else in the state started going, you know what, we have to let them kind of do that, because they didn't want to be that tyrannical, that oppressive. And so calmer heads prevailed and weren't willing to actually do the evil deeds of the governor. And so we lucked out. But what really should have happened is they should have not just done that. They should have made a mass appeal to all the counties and demanded that the people start assembling at all of your counties and holding them accountable to say they have. But folks, this is why First Amendment petitions are so critical, because this is how we educate. No state can make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen, like that governor was doing and like many governors were doing. And we saw that tyranny in Washington state. You know what? There wasn't one county in Washington state that arose against that. And Illinois, one would think that Illinois is a far more liberal state, and it is in some ways because of Chicago. But there's still good, strong counties in Illinois, but unfortunately, they didn't do what they needed to do. So let's go on, and this is what he says. The forbidding aspect of a naked creed, according to which a process instituted by a single state is to terminate in the ascendancy of a minority of seven. He's talking about the game of seven states versus 17 at the time. Over a majority of 17 has led its partisans to disguise its deformity under the position that a single state might rightfully resist an unconstitutional and tyrannical law of the United States, keeping out of view the essential distinction between a constitutional right and the natural and universal right of resisting intolerable oppression. See, he's laying it out right there. He says you have this universal right to stand up against it. And you do. Unfortunately, at the county level, you just can't secede. But you can actually rise up to actually take your stand. It's not that you can't do it. And in some ways, you know, you actually have to draw that line and say, bring it on. But you have to appeal to the other counties in that union of that state, because that's what the counties have done in creating the state. They have equally created a union in basically empowering a state government with limited powers to govern them. They never gave, there's not one government in this United States, not one state government that has the power to lay that type of tyranny upon its people. I want you to understand the magnitude of what I just said. Nobody had the power to do what they did. And most of us didn't understand, and we allowed that to happen. So, as we kind of push forward, this is what he says. He says, with a like policy, the nullifiers, see, now he's got this, he's calling them nullifiers, those who are out there nullifying, pass over the state of things at the date of the proceedings of the Virginia and particular doctrines and arguments to which they were opposed, without an attention to which the proceedings in this, as in other cases, may be insecure against a perverted construction. So, got to remember that South Carolina was one of the states that opposed the Virginia resolutions in calling upon other states to work together, to interpose, to unite on the principles of enforcing their compact, which is what we have to do with the counties. And so he's basically saying, you know, with this type of policy, the nullifiers are jumping over or pass over the state of things at the date of the proceedings with Virginia. So he's basically saying they're ignoring what we really did. It might be remarked also that the champions of nullification attach themselves exclusively to the third resolution, averting their attention from the seventh resolution, which ought to be coupled with it. So in the Virginia resolutions, you've got the third and the seventh. Don't worry, he's going to cite them. He's actually going to read them in their entirety here so that you can see how the third and seventh must be coupled together. It's like having somebody read the scriptures and taking one line out of a scripture, one verse, or taking a couple of verses out of a whole chapter and basically making something out of, you know, in contrast or actually in conflict with the intent of the scriptures itself. This happens all the time. I mean, I remember in the 80s, homosexual churches basically took the line because so many people at that point in time, enough people at that point in time were illiterate regarding the gospel that many people actually said, hey, you know, the Bible says, love thy brother as thyself. You know, hey, there you go. This, you know, this is godly love. And they perverted it just like that. And that's what he's basically getting to. Resolution, which ought to be coupled with it, and from the report also, which comments on both and gives a full view of the object of the object, in other words, their intent of the legislature on the occasion. Returning to the epoch of the proceedings, in other words, going back to that time, the facts of the case are that Congress had passed certain acts bearing the name of the Alien and Sedition Laws, which Virginia and some other states regarded as not only dangerous in their tendency, but unconstitutional in their text, and as calling for a remedial interposition of the states. Now, right there, he basically says exactly what they were doing. The intent of what they were doing was calling for interposition of the states. Not the single state. The one state is just going to interpose and do it by itself. Interposition is taking the necessary action in uniting and forcing the federal government to get back into the scope and framework of the Constitution. It was found also that not only was the constitutionality of the acts vindicated by the predominant party, but that the principle was asserted at the same time that a sanction to give acts given by the supreme judicial authority of the United States was a bar to any interposition, whatever, on the part of the states, even in the form of legislative declarations, and the acts in question were unconstitutional. So he's actually tying to the fact that the federal judiciary was actually in support of these Alien and Sedition Acts. And this is why when we went through the report on the Virginia report on the resolutions, Madison said they don't even have the jurisdiction or the authority to be involved in this. They are not judges when it comes to violations of the Constitution, especially when they're the ones violating it. So he goes on and he says, under these circumstances, the subject was taken up by Virginia in her resolutions and pursued at the ensuing session of the legislature in a comment explaining and justifying them. Her main and immediate objective, evidently being to produce a conviction everywhere that the Constitution had been violated by the obnoxious acts, and to procure a concurrence and cooperation of the other states in effectuating a repeal of the acts. In other words, demanding that those acts be rescinded. In other words, if you look at Republic Review doesn't say, hey, you know, can you reconsider that? It sends directives to Congress from the states. Once you have a majority of the states that can actually pull Congress from their chambers back to their states and say, you have violated your oath, you have committed treason against this state, and we will no longer allow you to serve and represent the people of your congressional district or of this state, period. They have that power. It's right there in Article 4. And Section 3 of the 14th Amendment demands it, saying you are now ineligible, and if Congress isn't going to enforce this, then we will. And as a matter of fact, you know, the best way you can actually make it so that a politician in Congress, you know, if they want to play, and if actually Congress says that you are, you know, they're not going to extradite you, because people say, well, what happens if that happens? Then the state will literally have the authority to go in and revoke that person's residency and ability to live in that state, and actually pack that person up and deport them, so that now they are no longer even eligible because they're no longer residents of that state. I mean, it's literally drawing the line and saying, then you're out. And then now where are you? Because you're not representing us. And it's that simple, folks. We have all the power. We'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so kind of moving on here. She accordingly asserted and offered her proofs at great length that the acts were unconstitutional. Now, as a matter of fact, I think right here, he's really saying more about Kentucky. What actually happened was Kentucky audited what Jefferson did. When you read the Kentucky resolution, he painstakingly goes through the first six or so resolutions identifying how each of the acts violated different parts of the Constitution. So Jefferson went more through the audit process, and then Madison, Virginia, came along accordingly and asserted and offered her proofs at great length that the acts were unconstitutional. She asserted, moreover, and offered, and get this, this is what he says, offered her proofs that the states had a right in such cases to interpose. Not nullify, to interpose. First, in their constituent character, to which the government of the United States was responsible, and otherwise as specially provided by the Constitution. And further, that the states, in their capacity of parties to and creatures of the Constitution, had an ulterior, not ulterior, ulterior right, a supreme right to interpose. So I, you know, just got to highlight this, that they had the superior right to interpose, notwithstanding any decision of a constitutionalist authority. However, it might be the last resort under the forms of the Constitution, in cases falling within the scope of its functions, could not preclude an interposition of the states as the parties which made the Constitution and as such possessed an authority paramount to it. Okay, so, I mean, you got to kind of look at, you know, what he just said there. He says that, you know, bottom line, you can't preclude the parties, because bottom line, they are the parties which made the Constitution and as such possessed an authority paramount to it. Not the courts, not the Supreme Court, not Congress, not the president, the parties. That was their compact. Remember, the federal government didn't exist. The Constitution was created, and when ratified, the states basically came along and acquiesced and created the federal government. Now, where did the body of the federal government come from? It came from the states. Where did the president come from? He came from a state, and the court system came from the states as well. This is why in my last dialogue with Angeline, on Monday, I brought it up in our conversation that in a Republican form of government, representation should be, and actually You know, you can't have representation of all 50 states in the president, but there's no reason why we do not have a full representative court where the states actually identify their Supreme Court justice that is a part of the Supreme Court. Now, as people start hearing this, they're going to go, oh my gosh, because this is how we absolutely pull up the roots of the corrupt, evil Ivy League and how they've basically come down this path of redefining the Constitution and perverting the law in association with the Bar Association. This is, if you want to end the Bar Association and the, and I will tell you, the stranglehold that our court system has on this nation, we have to revise the Supreme Court and make it a Republican form of Supreme Court. Now, the justices will no longer have a lifetime term. It has only been proven that when you grant lifetime terms to justices, that they actually get enabled in trying to do things, and they're really good at wordsmithing or soothsaying, getting you to think, well, that's not really bad behavior. I am, you know, doing my job in trying to stretch the law to find out what's the best process. No, they don't have that power. They don't have that authority to find out what the best process is. The Constitution dictates what the best process is, folks. And so I know that it actually shakes some people, but, you know, you actually hear how the progressives have stacked the courts in the past because the ambiguity of the court, they've been able to do that. We redefine it to a representative court to where each state makes sure. And, you know, if they're, the best way to ensure that there is no biases, if something of the state itself between other states, is active, you know, where one state is suing. I'll give you a good case in point. Wyoming has been trying to ship coal out of the Washington port, and Washington has refused, basically because they say they have the right to do that. The Commerce Clause doesn't allow that. Washington State has been clear in violation. As a matter of fact, if anybody wants to do a Commerce Clause petition, let me know. As a matter of fact, if you know people that are involved in corporations that are being suppressed by the states, this is the process. Instead of using the court system, this is the process. All we have to do is point out that Washington State has no constitutional standing or authority and demand that Wyoming have its ability to ship coal. Now, the fact of the matter is, no coal should be shipped to China from America. China cannot receive, as a matter of fact, the president of the United States is obligated to recognize that China is a hostile nation and we will no longer do trade with them. I've already said this in my presidential series, that the United States has an obligation to identify its enemies and make sure that we're not trading with them. We can't play these. Every time we play in the realm of compromise, we end up losing. If we stay on the high road, we will never lose. And we have everything it takes to do what we need to do here in America. Anyway, paragraph 8, which is the next paragraph. In this view of the subject, there is nothing which excludes a natural right in the states individually more than in any portion of an individual state suffering under palpable or blatant and insupportable wrongs from seeking relief by resistance and revolution. He's basically saying it's not that they don't have this right. It's a natural right that they have this right to do this. But it follows from no view of the subject that a nullification of a law of the U.S. can, as is now contended, belong rightfully to a single state as one of the parties to the Constitution. the state not ceasing to avow its adherence to the Constitution. A plainer contradiction in terms or a more fatal inlet of anarchy cannot be imagined. Now, I hope you're listening to this because I'm not going to editorialize that much. This is some real golden nuggets here. And Madison goes on in paragraph 10 and says, "And what is the text in the proceedings of Virginia, which is this spurious doctrine of nullification claims for his parentage? It is found in the third of the resolutions of 98, which is in the following words," quote, and this, I told you he was going to get into this, quote, "that in case of deliberate and palpable and dangerous exercise of powers not granted by the compact," he points out, constitutional compact, "the states who are parties thereto have a right and are in duty bound to interpose." Now, again, I'm going to go back to the beginning of this part of this phrase after the constitutional compact, "the states," plural. And he's going to poke this and make, he's going to make hay out of this because he wants everybody to understand that he never said state. He said states. "Interpose for arresting the progress of evil and for maintaining within the respective limits the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them. Now, is there anything here from which a single state can infer a right to arrest or annul an act of the general government, which it may deem unconstitutional? So far from it, that the obvious and proper inference precludes such a right on the part of a single state." And this is where it's highlighted. "Plural number being used in every application and term." In other words, the plural usage of the word. He says number, but I think it's better for you to understand plural as far as, you know, a multiple in the usage of states. He uses states to clearly identify that it required a very specific, you know, more than just one. And it wasn't just two or three. It needed to be a majority. Unfortunately, he doesn't say that here. But when it comes down to the compact, you don't require, when it comes to enforcing the compact, you only need a majority. If you're going to make a change to the compact, you have to have 3/4. And this is why he points out that the nullifiers were saying, you know, if you want to force us to have to do this, it'll take 3/4 of the states to actually, you know, inflict this upon us. And that's not true. That's what he's going on and saying. Bottom line, when you really look at this, and there's some more golden nuggets coming up, that when you really look at what Madison is saying, Madison is pointing out that even though the federal government has failed to use the Article 5 process, it is not one state's job to say, hey, this is wrong. Every state, as a matter of fact, he pointed this out in the, help me out here. He pointed this out in the Virginia resolutions, and he also pointed this out in the Federalist Papers, that they had to either interpose or they had, because when one term of the contract is violated, they have the right to secede. Now, here's the point, folks, because there's a lot of people out there that want their states to secede. It's actually gaining traction in Texas that maybe they need to secede from the union. And in a way, I'll say this, that if there was one state that needed to secede from the union that would really protect America, that would be Texas. Because if you look, the majority of the illegals that are coming in are coming across the Texan border, the Texas border. Now, we can't do much about California, but we in Arizona, just think if Arizona seceded and both of those states held that line and forced the funneling up, then all the other states around California, well, the West Coast, you know, it makes it harder for this invasion to continue. especially when you look at the throughput, because you've got trains that come up into Texas. There's just this mass highway that comes up and crosses the Rio Grande and so forth. That's why when you look at where the mass number, because going up into New Mexico, you have to get up into the Rockies, and that's the same thing with Arizona. You've got to deal with those mountains. California, it's a different story. You're actually out on the coast. So the people coming up from Central America and so forth, they kind of have to cross over those mountains. In other words, Mexico really has a task of shuttling them across that. Because I'm telling you what, if you're walking by foot, it's not, I mean, Mexicans come up from Mexico, but you don't see these trains of Central Americans and Latin American from Latin America down there, south of Mexico is what I'm trying to refer. You know, you don't see them doing caravans going across the mountains. You know, sometimes terrain is a great funnel. I mean, as I say all the time, to poke, you know, Denver in the eye a little bit, not that I hate Denver, but, you know, Denver was created because of those Rocky Mountains. When the pioneers and the people who were coming across came across, and they go, I'm going to California for this manifest destiny. Many people, I mean, they were so, you know, broken, and the, you know, they were so tired as they trekked across the Great Plains. And then they got to at the foot of the Rocky Mountains. They go, oh my gosh, I heard there were mountains, but I didn't realize there was, they were this immense, and there was, you know, the magnitude was this great, because it's not just a few miles of mountains, folks. It's like 100 miles of mountains, or 100 something miles of mountains, up and down and up and down and around. And you know, if the toll was great coming across the plains on you, and your whatever wagon, hand cart, whatever it is that you were using to cross that plains with your personal possessions, and you look at those mountains and you go, you know what, I don't even think I could do that in a season with this rickety cart. So guess what? Those people who wanted to go ended up staying there in Denver, and now we have Denver. In other words, as I like to say, Denver is the land of quitters. Because a lot of people just went there and said, it's a beautiful area. I love Denver. But the fact that Denver became as big as it did, as fast as it did, was just because there were so many people that were so broken that they just said, you know what, this is not bad. And it's not. It's a great place to live. But, well, now that they have progressives, it's a terrible place to live. But moving back into the doctrine of nullification, this is paragraph 13. In the next place, the course and scope of the reasoning requires that by the rightful authority to interpose in the cases and for the purpose referred to was meant not the authority of the states singly and separately, but by their authority. Now he's saying states possessive, by their authority as the parties to the Constitution. The authority which in the fact made the Constitution, the authority which being paramount to the Constitution, was paramount to the authorities constituted by it, to the judiciary as well as other authorities. In other words, as I said, he is asserting the fact that the parties have more, all the authority, that the judiciary, the president, does not possess the authority when the majority of states take a stand. The resolution clearly derives the asserted right of interposition for arresting the progress of usurpations by the federal government. I mean, so if you haven't noticed, folks, he keeps on saying interposition. Never does he use the term nullification. Interposition forces the recension, forces the retraction, and forces the dismantling of anything unconstitutional. If you derive anything from what he is saying here, that's exactly what Republic Review does. So I have to take a side here and go, why? Why are so many people out there actually lying and misleading people about Republic Review? We have the Convention of States doing it, and we even have the John Birch Society and other groups saying, no, 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 that's not the way. And clearly, this is exactly what Madison is saying. Prove me wrong. Show me any other document where Madison says, no, we got to go to the courts, or no, 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 we have to call for a convention, or no, no, we have to call for nullification. Folks, I'm not putting words in Madison's mouth. He is speaking to us from the dust as to what has to happen. And clearly, he's not saying that you, as U.S. citizens, need to basically, you know, secede from the Union and become sovereign citizens. He's not saying that either. As a matter of fact, that's the last thing we need. It's just like states seceding from the Union. We need everybody. We need all hands on deck to demand compliance. And here's the problem with all of these people that have become sovereign citizens. Now they're just absolutely worthless. They're absolutely worthless because they can't vote. They have no say. They have no rights. They shouldn't even be here. They made the big mistake of deciding to step out of their citizenry of this great nation. Well, now they need to decide what nation they want to be deported to, because there's no land on the earth that doesn't have government. And so if they want to go to the no government, no man's land, they all need to pull together all this money they've been saving from their taxes and buy that island, to buy that land and then govern themselves, because they're not entitled to basically live in our shadows and actually cause problems, because that's all they're going to do. They tell us they don't have to abide by our traffic laws. You can't hold me in court. You know, yeah, there's so many, and as a matter of fact, the only reason the court and the law enforcement has not actually dealt with them the way they should be dealt with is because the progressives are basically saying, you know, everybody has constitutional rights, which is absolutely unconstitutional. They've redefined that. The only people that are entitled to the protections under this Constitution are U.S. citizens. That was clear by the framers when they deported, even though the Constitution didn't exist at that time, but they actually quickly concluded that every single one of these Tories that supported Britain during the Revolutionary War needed to be deported. And I say anybody that wants to step away or actually wants to try to invoke unconstitutional change in America, they all should be exported. They all should be deported. But I'm kind of a hard butt, right? Yeah, I don't mince words. You know, there are consequences to our decisions. You know, we all know that, and we all, you know, okay, I'll stop doing this. I'll stop gambling. You know, if you're struggling trying to stop something, some addiction, then, you know, we always kind of cling to, I'll do it later. Folks, you're running out of time. And those folks who pulled the trigger, there are consequences to that hard decision you made. I'm sorry. So this is what he says, from the fact that its powers, back to paragraph 13, from the fact that its powers were limited to the grant made by the states, a grant certainly cannot be made. And I have to point out that he's saying here very clearly that it was the plurality of the states that granted this limited power. A grant certainly not made by a single party to the... Okay, so I'll say this in context. As I'm breaking this up and looking at this, I think it's really important that I kind of stop and highlight. But let me read this whole thought in its entirety. From the fact that its powers were limited to the grant made by the states, plural, a grant certainly not made by a single party to the grant, but by the parties to the compact containing the grant. You got it? So he's really pointing out that it was the forming of the Union that created this grant of power. A single state can't do it. The mode of interposition in extraordinary cases is left by the resolution to the parties themselves, as the mode of interpretation lies within the parties to other constitutions in the event of usurpation of powers not redeemable under the forms and by the means provided by the constitutions. Now, what he's saying here is he's basically saying that in this constitution, by the means of the parties granting this power, they possess this full authority to interpose and say, look, subcontractor, we hired you to only mow our grass. We did not give you the authority to start painting our houses and start digging ditches and start paving highways and then give us a bill for that. Even though you have made our lives and our, you know, our businesses function better by doing so, you had no authority to do this. If it be asked why a claim by a single state, or actually by a single party, to the constitutional compact to arrest a law deemed by it a breach of the compact was not expressly guarded against, the single answer is sufficient that a pretension so novel, so anomalous, so anarchical was not and could not be anticipated. In other words, this whole concept that the union would even allow, you know, parties to become anarchical. And what is anarchical? I'm not going to do this. I'm going to do my own thing. You can't force me to do anything. That's anarchy. And so when they formed this union, he basically came right out and said they didn't anticipate that there would be states that would actually try to go down this path of anarchy by staying in the union. Now, when the southern states seceded, folks, they had this right. They had the constitutional right, and Lincoln was wrong. But Lincoln chose to prosecute his tyranny instead of using his noggin and actually pointing to the real problem du jour, which was slavery. And what I'm trying to tell you, folks, is Lincoln did not see slavery as the evil. He saw the evil that the Union was going to fraction and break on his watch, and he would be labeled as the failure president throughout the annals of history. Did he not do what he did? And I am here to tell you that it took 2 years and Lincoln to finally become prostrate. 2 years of failing in battles. The Union could not win a fight until he finally prostrated and prayed to the Lord and acknowledged the fact that it can't be that they can't leave the Union, because clearly they did and could. It had to be over the real issue at hand, which was slavery. And so everybody says that he won that war because it was about slavery. No, that whole war changed complete context from you can't leave the Union to we're ending slavery. And when the radical, after he was killed, well, we'll have to get into that. As a matter of fact, we just finished paragraph 13, and when we come back tomorrow, we'll start off with paragraph 14. Folks, I hope you're really garnering this. There's a lot here, and he goes over this over and over again. That's how emphatic Madison is at this moment in time in his life. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.